Welcome to WYSO's 2012 Community Voices Special, the first of two parts. I'm Sarah Buckingham. This hour, radio stories produced in this year's Community Voices training course. What's Community Voices? It's sort of WYSO's third department. There's news, music, and community voices, and it's all about getting local voices on the air. We help people from all over the Miami Valley record essays, poems, and commentaries. We work with public school teachers and college professors who want to bring radio into their classrooms. And each year, we gather a group of listeners and teach them to become producers. They learn to record and edit audio, develop and research a story idea, conduct interviews, write for radio, and produce audio documentaries by, for, and about the Miami Valley. We'll hear those stories this hour. Our training course starts with something called a vox pop, short for vox populi, which is Latin, meaning voice of the people. These man-on-the-street interviews allow our trainees to get their feet wet before diving into a feature story. Here's a campaign season vox pop from Basim Blunt.
Men spending most of their lives living in a pastime paradise. With the presidential election this year, WYSO Community Voices took microphones to Dayton's West Side and posed the question,
how do you think America has responded to having the first African-American president?
I think it's given a false sense of equality.
Here's a man that, because his name is Obama, they said he's a Muslim.
Any means necessary, get President Obama out of office.
We really haven't gone that far in regards to race relations.
I feel like overall it is a positive response to having the first black president. People who are not happy with him being black refuse to acknowledge the success that he has had.
Most people in America has gotten over it. There are some racists that will never get over it. Just like the same core that came up with Klansmen after the Civil War.
He has been ridiculed more than any other president during my birth time.
There are a group of individuals that are very judgmental of everything that the president does. You know, everything that he does is negative.
He just flies in the face of their stereotypes that they want to hold on to.
It created a divide, because that's where the Tea Party came into power and people were carrying guns to presidential addresses and different things.
There's a portion of America, it's made them bitter and in some cases almost revengeful.
Terrible. Very disrespectful to the office.
When he was addressing the whole world and someone called him a liar, you know, he should have been in jail. That is treason.
But I think the American people understand his vision. That's what they voted for. And they understand his heart, and they know that we're moving in the right direction.
Those responses were recorded from the Princeton Rec Center in the heart of Dayton's African American community. For Community Voices, this is Basim Blunt.
Basim is a New Jersey transplant and a teacher at the Dayton Business Technology High School. Don't miss his audio documentary on the history of funk music in Dayton next week on part two of the Community Voices special. Yellow Springs resident Will Davis says radio merges two of his passions, storytelling and technology. Will is in the Master of Humanities program at Wright State University. Here's his vox pop.
Hello, I am a computer. I'm here at Wright State University, talking to a group of humanities students. I asked them what it means to be human.
Our consciousness, our level of consciousness, seems to be what separates us from other species, so some definition of humanity would probably involve that.
To be human is to have desires, wants, emotions, and connections with those around you.
I really think
human is pretty based on DNA, actually.
Having passions and desires and relationships.
To think about our emotions and our connections to each other and how we affect each other, the higher cognitive sort of things.
Excuse me, what does it mean to be human?
To be human is to be aware of how you interact with the world and the other beings that surround you.
You recognize yourself in the mirror.
Opposable thumbs.
Opposable thumbs and the ability to laugh.
Good answers. We heard from Kate Bonansegna, Alex Harrison, Jolene Pohl Crowell, Amber McCurdy, Matthew Eisen, Caitlin and Jacob Bauer, Abby Zienda, and Dr. Ava Chamberlain. Thanks a lot, everyone.
Consciousness, passion, desire, opposable thumbs. Can you believe no one said art? Some of the world's most beloved artists are noted for having a creative rebirth later in life. The phenomena has been studied by art historians, who characterize it as artists taking more risks with their work and quickly getting to the heart of what's being expressed. In this next story, Alexis Larson introduces us to one local woman who tapped into her creative energy later in life and found a sort of fountain of youth, which yielded an extraordinary body of work.
Winnie Fiedler came to Dayton nearly 70 years ago after being reunited with her husband Otto, who had returned from the war. She was a young bride with an Ivy League degree and the start of a promising career. She was the complete package. Young, smart, talented, beautiful. To many, it seemed like she had it all, but there was a giant missing piece that ached to be filled.
We came to Dayton. We eventually found an apartment. After he'd been home for a while, walking down Main Street with him, looking in the windows, and all of a sudden, I started to cry. What is the matter with me? I should be happy as a lark. My husband is home. I have no worries. He's making money. What's wrong with me? Well, I know now what was wrong with me. Here I was. I had experience in the beginning of a career, and I was doing nothing. I was doing nothing. Nobody knew me. Nobody valued what I was or what I had been. I wasn't a strong woman. I was defeated by the circumstances. And I think that happened to a lot of women at that time.
The sadness she speaks of is a stark contrast to the charming, happy intellectual I spent several magical evenings earlier this year getting to know. Like all things in life, there was no direct path to this moment. Each night, weather cooperating, Fiedler takes a trip outside to enjoy the sunset. This spring night is no exception. The colors of the sky stretch out in bright bands as far as the eye can see.
Oh, I just love to do this in the evening when the sun goes down. First of all, this is a great time for photography. You've got a wonderful light. It's called the sweet hour. I like to go over here and sit down under this tree, which is a great oak. Look at it. Don't you want to hug it? Here, let's sit here.
Seeing the world through Fiedler's eyes this night, everything seems brighter, richer, and more alive.
Look at how that orange is just so strong. It glows against the black outlines of the trees.
At age 60, after the death of her husband Otto, Fiedler began to study and experiment with photography. She became so passionate, she took on the monumental and expensive task of setting up her own darkroom so she could focus on her new love full-time. Photography was the gateway to her affair with art that has nurtured her for the last 30 years.
I took a number of courses at the Ohio Institute of Photography. I was 60 when I took the first course at OIP. Took a lot of pictures, spent a lot of time in the darkroom, had a great time. I didn't become an artist until long after I started to make things that I thought looked pretty good.
Her natural curiosity and time in the classroom had sparked a fire. She quickly went to work setting up a fully functioning darkroom in her house and experimenting with what was possible. Looking for a challenge, she became inspired by the composite prints of photographer Jerry Yulesman, whose body of work was driven by the idea that an image created in the darkroom needn't be defined by a single negative.
It's a technique that requires care, precision. Each image has to be properly exposed so it will look as though it was the same single image from the camera. If you're careful, about the 10th time you do that, it'll look good.
With the advent of digital photography, Fiedler felt it was time to take on some new challenges. And she did just that, delving into three-dimensional textile art with a vengeance. To some, it may seem an unexpected change from the contemporary photography pieces she had been working on. Still, she sees many similarities between the two.
I didn't start with the idea that this is what I'm going to accomplish. It grows. That's the way I've always worked with art. I start with an idea. I start with a thing. In my quilts, I often start with a fabric. I love that. Ooh, it's beautiful, it's sensual, it's sweet, it's pretty, or it's rough and textured, and let me do something with that.
Following the same creative process that drove her photography, the textile pieces that she has produced are loose and vibrant, with an unpredictable energy that surprises and delights the viewer. It's a far cry from the controlled and calibrated quilting that often comes to mind. Fiedler's art expresses as much youthful, happy energy as she does. The question on my mind as we sit outside to savor the visual treat of light turning to dark is what new medium or projects will this prolific artist take on next? It's a difficult question to answer.
You're more alive than a lot of 30-year-olds, you know? I mean, you've got it going on.
Well, it makes me think I want to hang around a little bit longer. It won't be much longer. There's something about being clearly in the last stage of a long life where some things don't matter the way they used to. And you live in the present because you don't know the future. And you've had such a long past, it's all jumbled. You have to have a reason to point at some particular thing. So you kind of live for the moment, as we're doing this at this moment right now.
For most dedicated artists, the act of creating is like breathing. It's the oxygen they require to stay healthy. At 90 years old, Dayton resident Winnie Fiedler is living proof of the power that lies in discovering and nurturing the artist that exists in each of us. There may not be a fountain of youth, but the joy, discovery, and satisfaction Fiedler has continued to harness from pushing the boundaries of what's possible with her art may just be the next best thing. This is Alexis Larson, living in the moment and reporting for WYSO's Community Voices Project.
You can see the quilt Wendy made from her husband Otto's old neckties on our website, wyso.org.
It must have been at least a half a lifetime ago. A friend sent me a birthday card that said, "When you're young, you want to be old, and when you're old, you want to be young. Things are really screwed up." I've often wondered, though, is that a universal truth? How do people really feel about their lives? I wanted to find out more. Hi, my name is Alan, and I'm with WYSO. And how old are you?
4.
Do you ever think about growing up and what it would be like to be grown up?
Yeah.
What do you think it's going to be like?
Really hard. I think it's going to be really hard.
What do you think a good age would be for you?
I like this age.
And tell me how old you are.
4.
What do you think it's going to be like when you grow up?
A paleontologist. 4.5.
Do you like being 4.5?
Yes.
What do you think it's going to be like when you're a teenager?
I don't know.
I'm 9 years old, and I wish I was 16 because I like having a sweet 16 party.
16 like I am right now because this is fun, and I don't want to grow up. 15 right now, and I think the perfect age would be something like 27, because you're finally done with school. Everything that's going to be legal is legal, and you have a job, and you still look good.
I am 27 years old. I like my age right now. So right now I'd say 27 is the ideal age.
My ideal age is 27. I was old enough to know what was going on at that point, and it was a very good year in my life.
And how old are you now?
Oh, unfortunately, I'm currently 61.
I'll be 32 September 10th. I probably wish I can. I'll be glad when I get 40 or 50, because I like to be the same age as Michael Jackson, try to get there.
So I'm 33, and my ideal age is 33, because I'm not 20. I don't think you know what's going on when you're 20. Like, you're living in the dream.
38.
And what do you think the ideal age is?
About 45.
45? Why is that?
Well, maturity, and, you know, yeah. That's about it.
48.
And what do you think the ideal age is?
40.
And why is that?
In between.
In between what?
Young and old. That's kind of in the middle. You kind of got experience, and then you don't got experience.
55.
And what do you think the ideal age is?
32. Sort of the middle ground between just wise enough, yet not too wise.
I'm 72, and I think the ideal age is whatever age you are. Enjoy what you are.
I'm satisfied with what it is right now.
Okay. How old are you right now?
91.
Well, all of that might be true, but now that I'm closer to being 100 than I am to being 16, I receive birthday cards like this that say, "Analysis Spock, if all the candles on that cake were to be lit simultaneously..."
Annihilation, Jim. Total, complete, absolute annihilation.
Well, maybe. But I am hoping that the flames from all of those candles might just keep me warm on a cold winter's night. For WISO, this is Alan Steiger.
That was a Vox Pop from reference librarian and Yellow Springs resident Alan Steiger. Our next story comes from Antioch College student Jennifer Carlson. Jennifer is nearing the end of a year-long fellowship at WISO. And she turned 21 this year, so naturally, her story is about beer. Several new beer makers are setting up shop in the Miami Valley, thanks to a state law that makes it easier to start microbreweries and distilleries. For Shane and Jackie Creeping Bear in Yellow Springs, a love for beer and a passion for science and art come together to bring you the Vitruvian Brew Company.
Shane and Jackie are cleaning bottles, getting ready to make some beer. They've been brewing together for 8 years, but this is the first time that they are brewing from their new space with professional equipment. After they're done preparing, the real process begins.
You're just going to put some ingredients in and boil them in water. And kind of just add them in at specific times. Malt, hops, water, yeast. Enjoy.
Shane pours water into the brew kettle and turns the gas on. Jackie writes down the recipe.
It was like pretty much boiling.
As the water heats up, they pour the ingredients in and stir.
So, once we get it back to a good rolling boil, we'll add the hops and start.
It's not long before a nice aroma of fresh beer fills the space. Starting up a brewery was an idea that they used to joke about. It was only after starting their family and deciding to lay their roots in Yellow Springs that became more concrete. In April, they moved into a warehouse building and began construction. Jackie walks me through the space.
One of the parts that we're really excited about... Right on the bike path. It opens right into the bike path. So we want to have a nice a little patio and, you know, place to lock up your bike so that you can come right in. You can see the kegs right there. You can fill your growler and be on your way, or you can hang out, check out the brew process, whatever. So this would be like the general reception area.
Shane and Jackie both work, and they have three young daughters. Some would think that'd be reason enough to save a dream like this for a later date, but it doesn't seem to be holding them back at all. And neither does the recent boom in the brewery business.
It's not that we want to compete with Budweiser. We want to replace them in our area.
They're setting out to do things that most microbreweries would not do. The bottles will be hand-painted and silk-screened. They will be reusing bottles. You'll be able to buy small growlers and kegs. They will also be making signature brews for bars and restaurants in the area. One of the first lines they'll put on the market will be called the Hard Water IPA, on account of the Yellow Springs water that they use. They're making an effort to appeal to the locavore consumer market.
We want people in our area to drink VBC beer and to know that name.
The name, Vitruvian Brew Company, brings us back to the place where Shane and Jackie met, Antioch College. The symbol that the college uses comes from the Vitruvian Man, a famous drawing by Leonardo da Vinci. It is said to represent the blending of the arts and sciences.
You know, the idea was meant as an architectural model. Antioch extended it to education. We want to extend it to brewing. You know, brewing is a very scientific process. You know, if you want to have a good, successful product, you have to market it artfully. People don't, you know, want to buy things that aren't aesthetically pleasing.
They're learning how to open up their own business together while at the same time holding very separate but important roles.
Right now I'm getting deep into the yeast propagation process, which is a lot of fun for me. It's some pretty heavy science. And yeast is such a really, you know, important role in beer. And it, you know, propagating your own strand really allows you to have control over flavor, over alcohol content, over shelf life, all of these things that are just so important. So it's been really exciting.
As Jackie dives into the science, Shane works on the aesthetic side. He oversees all of the marketing work that goes into everything from how they'll appeal to consumers to how the label will be designed.
He's the art and I'm the science.
Jackie's kind of like Batman and I'm Robin, I would say.
Everybody needs a good sidekick, Shane.
And it's the dream, you know. It's our dream. This is our thing. So we're making it happen, and we're happy to be putting the time in and, you know, securing our future as well.
The Vitruvian Brew Company expects to be selling beer by the end of this year. For WYSO's Community Voices, I'm Jennifer Carlson.
You're listening to WYSO's 2012 Community Voices Special, radio stories produced in this year's training course. I'm Sarah Buckingham. Most of us find it difficult to grieve the passing of a loved one. And when our parents die, it can be especially difficult, leaving us with regrets, guilt, and other unresolved feelings. We expect it. But what about their stuff? The tangible objects our parents have accumulated over a lifetime. What happens to all of it? Community Voices producer Mark Babb visited with an online estate auction company based in Cincinnati called Everything But the House as they sorted through the possessions of a recently deceased couple to try and find out what we leave behind and what it says about us.
There are pictures everywhere. My dad couldn't take a very good picture, I don't think. You know, okay. A lot of out-of-focus stuff, but they're little gems everywhere.
That's Bob Fries. His parents recently died 10 days apart from each other. I spoke with Bob at his parents' home in an affluent neighborhood in Cincinnati. The house had just been sold, and its new owners want to take possession in a few weeks. The house is an impressive, if a bit weathered, colonial from the early 1900s. The bushes are overgrown, and the pool in the backyard is covered by a plastic tarp held down with bags of sand. In the driveway, I meet Brian Graves, co-owner of the company that's going to inventory, photograph, and auction off the contents of the house. We come into the house through a garage into a lower-level family room. In it, we find a cluttered mess of furniture and boxes. A large banker's box lid full of prescription bottles sits on a TV tray next to a bookcase. I ask Brian to show me around. As he does, he sizes up potential for the auction.
You can see that this is a family that was here for a long period of time. Mm-hmm. I have period and antiques from New England. Mm-hmm. So 18th century Chippendale, six drawer chests. At the same time, you know, I'm looking at Bowback Windsors. One room adjacent, we have a circa 1860 Empire crotch mahogany bookcase.
Brian and his co-owner Jackie Denny started everything but the house in 2007. And their business has grown steadily in the last 5 years. He tells me that most people are completely overwhelmed by the prospect of sorting through their relatives' stuff. They have to get rid of things, but they still have attachments that make it hard to let go. When the auction is ready, there's often a day when potential bidders can walk through the house and inspect the items. Sometimes it's best if the family's not there.
The family member sitting at the front door in a chair, sizing up everybody that walks in, is a difficult scenario for them and the people that are interested in buying. It can become very personal and very emotional.
Brian believes in the auction process because he says you never know what significance people will place on a particular item. He tells me the story of a prior auction.
It was a Ladybug refrigerator magnet, plastic, faded, nothing, you know, that interesting. I even questioned why one of my crew leaders actually cataloged it on its own. And at the end of the day, that Ladybug magnet sold for $65.
Why?
The person that bought it had a similar one when they were a kid. They hung up their homework with it. They wanted to be able to show their kids.
From the kitchen, we climb up a set of stairs into the attic. On the wall, in a steep staircase, was a large painted portrait of what was probably one of the couple's grandchildren. A boy, maybe about 10, was pictured sitting casually on a front porch swing. The portrait wasn't tagged to be kept by the heirs, which seemed sort of sad. I wondered what would become of it.
What do you do, Brian, what do you do with something like this?
This is, you know, a painting. You know, typically something like this, it's a portrait, it's a family member, you know, it's obviously dated 1982. Well accomplished, you know, the person that did it did a great job, but of course it's a very personal item.
Is this going to hit the website?
I'd say it will, yeah. It's an original painting. Somebody put a heck of a lot of work into it. Let's let the public decide.
Let's let the public decide, he says. At the top of the stairs, Brian turns on a light to reveal an enormous expanse of clutter. Stacks of old National Geographic magazines, old electronics, old pennants, and dozens of open boxes of what looks to be junk.
So, of course, this is the last thing you see when you're on the appointment with the client.
The appointment is when Brian first tours the house with the family.
This is an accumulation of decades of we didn't have anywhere else to put it, we didn't want to throw it away, so let's put it up in the attic.
I ask him why he thinks we buy and hang on to so much stuff.
I think it's redirection of you know, an interest and a passion. It's something to keep, you know, keep ourselves busy, and it's not knowing when to stop. The hardest thing for us to do is walk into some of those situations where someone has spent their life's fortune buying things that they don't really need. People are attached to objects. The America is the accumulation nation, and people have a hard time giving things up. You know, it's definitely an exception when you have that person that has no attachment to anything.
Bob Fries seems like the exception. He's downstairs thumbing through his father's old blurry photographs. He's not interested in keeping much of his parents' stuff, except a couple of small items like this one that belonged to his father.
Yeah, like a little newspaper stand, you know, a silver newspaper stand where when you're eating breakfast, you put the newspaper in it, and it kind of stands up in front of you. Mm. Downstairs, you know, that was part of his, you know, memory of his life, his childhood even, because his father read off of that thing. It's got a little bent up now and stuff like that, a little older than it used to be, but it's just part of something I remember, and I'm fond of it.
Bob has a sense of ease about this transition in his life. As we talk, he becomes more and more interesting. He starts asking me about my recording equipment, and I learn that Bob has spent the last 40 years working on TV, music, and film productions. He even made a famous film called Ladies and Gentlemen, the Rolling Stones, in collaboration with the band. Before that, he spent 5 years in New York making avant-garde films for John Lennon and Yoko Ono.
At that point, I was editing this huge amount of film, you know, which was a bunch of, you know, frame by frame by frame by frame. You know, Yoko would say, do this, and then she'd go away and tear your eye. Anyway, it was great. And I lived at the hotel. We lived there for 6 months doing this stuff. And the film was Imagine.
As Bob told me the stories of his work and the people he'd gotten to know, the weight of the situation seemed to lift. It at least became clear that his parents had left behind more than old furniture and magazines.
Imagine no possession. I wonder if you can.
For WYSO's Community Voices, I'm Mark Batt.
This next story from Tracy Staley explores how a community garden can be both a bridge to the past and the future. Almost 100 refugees from the Central African country of Burundi are building new lives in Dayton. Their homeland has endured decades of civil war, forcing many to spend much, if not all, of their lives in refugee camps, and now to start over in the United States. The transition has not been easy. But on a farm on the outskirts of Montgomery County, these refugees have found a place to grow.
On a warm spring morning, a group of Burundian refugees gather on a Jefferson Township farm for the first day of planting. They work in pairs, turning the soil and tossing seeds into the earth. They'll plant beans, corn, onions, tomatoes, and various greens on the 2 acres, one of the largest community gardens in Montgomery County. They've been growing their own food in Dayton since the first wave of refugees came to the region in 2007. Until now, their gardens were limited to small lots near their homes in Dayton. This summer, thanks to the generosity of a local physician who welcomed them to her farm, they have the opportunity to take a significant step towards selling produce at local markets. Damien Njeriko, a Burundian refugee who moved here with his wife and children in 2008, is working in the garden. He shares his hopes for this project through a translator.
If we were able to have more land so we can farm and harvest a lot of things, so we can we have been able to feed ourselves and to sell them at the different store, so we can have extra money which may help us in our need, like buying things we need home, as soap and the other necessity we need home.
Njeriko was born in Burundi when he was a child in the 1960s. His father, two brothers, and a sister were killed in fighting between the Hutu and Tutsis. Njeriko went to a refugee camp in Tanzania. He lived there for decades, farming and raising a family. He moved back to Burundi once, but another bout of unrest drove him back to the refugee camp. When Tanzania began to close the camps, Njeriko and his family were given the chance to resettle in the United States. He had just come back from a walk when he heard the news.
I was really happy to hear that I was going to come to go to America, a powerful country, rich country, that help other country also. So I may be able to help myself, to have a lot of opportunities so I can help myself and help my people back home.
But it hasn't been easy. He has struggled to find and keep work. His first job at an auto parts packaging company ended with layoffs after 8 months. Since then, he's worked on and off through temp agencies and spent a year volunteering at Goodwill. His family in Burundi call in hopes he might be able to send money back home. It is difficult, financially and emotionally. Our group of people, he says, it is hard for us to find jobs. We've spent years in refugee camps, so we didn't have a lot of skills. We are struggling to find jobs, and we can't even fill out an application by ourselves. Njeriko and his family have found community in their church, a congregation of Burundians and Rwandans that meet at a small Methodist chapel in Huber Heights. One recent Sunday, a guest speaker shares a message from the Psalms. It's a story of a man whose faith is tested when he compares his difficult life to the easy path of the evil and rich men around him.
Many of you here have stories that you can tell of your lives in Burundi, Rwanda, and what it was like during the genocide, during the ethnic violence. You've come to the United States mostly with nothing. You have to learn how us crazy Americans live.
The pastor's words ring true. As the Burundians move through this new life in the United States, their pasts carry with them. This is Issa. Like Damien Njeriko, he lost his family in the war. He shares his story through a translator.
At that time, I almost lost my mind. I want to kill myself. And it was night. I was walking around, my feet. I was walking around. And so I saw a group. Went to Tanganyika. It's a lake, Tanganyika. So I saw people who were just riding a boat. They were flying, using boat. And they just kind of say, oh, come over here. We can take you with us. We can take you. And so we can flee to Congo.
In the Congo, Issa worked as a fisherman. War then forced him again into a refugee camp in Tanzania. He came here in 2008 with his wife and four children.
Tanzania, I was given a place to live, and nobody came to ask me for rent or anything. So when I get here, life is good, but still very hard because I have bills to pay. Anything I do, I have a price on it.
When refugees like Issa arrive, they are helped by Catholic Social Services of the Miami Valley, a nonprofit that receives funding to resettle refugees. They help with housing, English classes, government assistance, and other essentials. But eventually, their aid goes away. Issa has high hopes for the garden project. Farming is a strong part of Burundian culture, he says.
Farming is it's a kind of automatic thing. It's a kind of family pride. Whatever, that was the job that my parents were doing. And wherever we're going to school, back home, after school, that's what we do home. So farming is something very important to us because it's what practically we grew up doing. And so it's very important to me.
Lucy Beachdale, who oversees community gardens for Five Rivers Metro Parks in Dayton, thinks the Burundian garden could help diversify the produce available in the Miami Valley. For example, Burundians harvest and eat pigweed, an edible yet rare item at most markets and groceries, that tastes similar to spinach.
It might be sold at farmers markets. It might be sold to specialty markets. So if there were a place that was selling African foods, They might be very interested in buying fresh produce that's not your standard stuff that American gardeners or farmers are growing.
Whatever the garden brings in the future, it already creates a sense of peace for Damien Njeriko. In a place so different than his home, planting and growing his own food is a familiar comfort.
It just reminded me that it's over the world. You can get some places you can still be able to grow things.
For WYSO Community Voices, I am Tracy Staley. Our next story comes from Wally Ream, a Yellow Springs cabinet maker. Wally says great radio has always moved him, and as he listened, he wondered if he could do it himself. He came to WYSO to learn how. Wally's story takes us to the Glen Helen Nature Preserve near Yellow Springs, where non-native plants such as bush honeysuckle have been taking over the understory of the forest. Last November, the preserve received a $70,000 grant from the Nature Conservancy to remove these invasive species. The target area for the South Glen Restoration Project is a 2.5-mile stretch alongside the Little Miami River. Each Saturday this year, volunteers join the staff as they attempt to reclaim the forest.
Yeah, big boy.
George Berry is land manager at Glen Helen Nature Preserve.
Tell me what you just did.
Well, I limbed a very large honeysuckle. That sucker is 8 inches at the base, easy.
How long would it have to be here to grow to that size?
50 years. This is what we call a mother plant. So if they came in 65, what is that, 50 years, more or less?
On this Saturday morning, Beery is leading a team of nine, mostly volunteers.
So this is big stuff, guys. It doesn't get much worse than this.
We can't even do an acre of this a day. It's too intense. I mean, realize now that this oxbow is the most difficult we found.
In the oxbow section of the South Glen, the honeysuckle is all around. It grows in clusters and has long, arching trunks. Imagine a drooping flower bouquet, only 10 feet high, and instead of blossoms, a thick tangle of branches and leaves. I interrupt Andy Wilson of Fairborn and ask him to explain what he and the other volunteers are doing.
Well, they've cut large amounts of the invasive plants, the olive and the honeysuckle and a few other things, and it's in piles in the woods, and we're grabbing onto the cut limbs and trunks and dragging them to where they're chopping them up so they can make other piles out of it.
There's lots of chopping going on. Where it's possible, the managers prefer to use a huge chipper to pulverize the plants. But this section of the glen is remote, and today the tool of choice is the machete. Rachel Smith is an Antioch College student. She chose this project for her spring internship.
Had you ever used a machete before this?
Yeah, I spent my last year in Ecuador and Colombia, so I'm pretty familiar with using machetes. I really enjoy using them. They're incredibly useful, and if you get a feel of how to do them, I think they're a really efficient way to work.
How about the one George gave you? Was it as sharp as...
It was a good one. I switched him out because I was using the orange one, which I hate. I don't like the ones that have a safety handle, so he gave me a heavier one that was just sharpened, and it was a lot better.
The grant from the Land Conservancy pays for two temporary employees who help lead the volunteer workdays. In prior years, there were occasional fall work weekends at the Glen, but progress was slow.
What we were seeing was that you could go out and get a bunch of people together and over a course of a month or two, maybe clear an acre.
Nick Budis is director of the Glen Helen Ecology Institute.
But do the math. We have a 1,000-acre preserve, and if you were taking out an acre of invasive species every year, you're putting yourself on the 1,000-year plan. And we really sought to accelerate our efforts because we didn't think that the glen could wait that long to heal. And frankly, we were just far too impatient to wait that long ourselves.
The current glut of non-native plants traces back to home landscaping projects in the 1940s, 50s, and 60s. Amur honeysuckle, for example, was introduced as an ornamental from Asia. Birds ate the seeds and carried them, and the plant escaped cultivation. Budis explains that the glen's shape makes it vulnerable. It's narrow, about 1/3 mile wide by 4 miles long.
We really try and help enforce the idea that a honeysuckle plant that's right outside of the glen might as well be inside the glen, and invasive species that are in our backyards will ultimately spread to natural areas and give people the knowledge and the tools to help be good stewards of their backyards and their communities. That's how you protect natural areas.
How many times do you think you've come after bush honeysuckle?
Oh, probably at least 20 now.
Again, Andy Wilson.
Been doing it for about 4 or 5 years.
It does seem like a Herculean task. What do you think keeps you coming back?
Just clearing a little bit at a time and seeing how good the woods look when you clear it and seeing the wildflowers come back. You've got to start someplace. So if you clear a little bit and keep on going.
Brian Ryan is a volunteer from Xenia. He sprays herbicide on a large honeysuckle stump.
Is that wet enough?
Yeah.
Yeah, you got to hit those really big ones twice. Let it soak in. And
okay.
Come back to it.
Okay, that's primed.
It seems like a big task. Do you find that daunting at all?
I used to be in construction, so how you have to look at it is you have to look at, this is my little square for the week. You can't look at the whole building. I mean, you know, we did high rises and, you know, like you couldn't say there's 20 stories. You had to say, I'm going to do 1/8 of one floor this week. That's it.
Vincent Lano of Enon volunteered over 100 times at the Glen before being hired as temporary staff for the project.
Do you have any particular feelings about honeysuckle?
Well, it's like a bully, you know, the school bully. This is the woods bully. And you can't just let it go on and on
without taking action. Its intention is to steal all the light from every other plant. And that's a bully. It's like someone who comes up in school and says, "Give me your lunch money." Well, then we can't have that.
Our land manager has a map in his office.
Again, Nick Budis.
He has an orange highlighter, and as they complete an area, he extends a little box around where that land was and is gradually able to watch the orange grow on the map along the Little Miami. We're making good progress, but it is a big, big project. We can use some help.
For WYSO's Community Voices, I'm Wally Ream.
Poison ivy.
No, that's okay. All great.
This way, Brian. That's a good one.
Yeah, I'm trying.
I like the look of that one. Here, hold on. We'll give you the name. Give me the machete.
We close this hour with another piece by Will Davis. Will produced this for the Third Coast International Audio Festival's Short Docs competition. For this contest, each story had to feature at least two neighbors, involve 3 seconds of silence, and include a color in the title. Here's what Will came up with. It's called Gray Day Gin and Juice.
I'm sitting on my front porch swing playing my guitar when I hear my neighbor Melvin call from across the street.
Baby, I love you. I'm coming over so you can play me a song.
He makes his way down the steps from his porch to the sidewalk, holding onto the handrail with one hand, swinging a paper bag with the other. He has electrodes stuck all over his head, like a 1950s science experiment, and wires leading to a small black box in his pocket. As he steps on my porch, a random cloud lets fall a gentle sprinkle of rain. He plunks down on the swing and holds out the paper bag. I shake my head. Living in the heart of the city is one big adventure after years of raising my family in the suburbs.
Them mother farmers. I know you don't like that other word, baby. That mother farmer's better find out what's wrong with me. The doctor won't let me drive until they find out what's wrong.
I suspect the problem is in his paper bag. His ex, Jan, who lives with him, has been driving him around now.
Baby, why don't you ever drink gin and juice with me?
I decide... What the hell? Just once. Sometimes I want to do a thing once. A thing like passing a pint of gin and juice with my alcoholic neighbor, a former drug dealer who claims he used to weigh over 400 pounds. I take a swig that burns like jet fuel.
Them doctors don't know nothing. I don't need them. I got my medicine right here.
He shakes the bag.
Baby, have another drink.
I take another slug. It burns just as bad the second time.
Sing me a song, baby. You know any Motown?
No, look at me. Do I look like I play Motown on this thing?
Then can you sing me a song about gin and juice?
Gin and juice, gin and juice. Melvin can't handle that gin and juice. Juice and gin, juice and gin. Damn, that bottle's almost empty again.
Oh now!
He's shouting out to the street, clapping his hands madly.
My baby wrote me a song about gin and juice.
When I finish, he claps again and then heads back across the street. As I open my front door, he yells from his porch,
I love you, baby. You know I love you.
I know you do, Melvin. I love you, too.
This hour, we've heard stories from Basim Blunt, Will Davis, Alexis Larson, Alan Steiger, Jennifer Carlson, Mark Babb, Tracy Staley, and Wally Ream. Tune in next week for more great local stories by local people on part two of WYSO's 2012 Community Voices special. For more information about Community Voices, visit wyso.org. We do a training every year, starting in January, It meets once a month for a Saturday seminar. You can sign up for our mailing list to receive updates. That's at yso.org. Applications for the 2013 training will be available in November. Community Voices projects are made possible by the DPNL Foundation and the Ohio Arts Council. This year's batch of trainees joins a growing group of Community Voices producers who contribute local stories to WYSO from all over the Miami Valley. You'll hear their work occasionally on WYSO Weekend, Sunday mornings at 10:30. And you can always find all the stories on WYSO.org under the Community Voices tab. While you're there, you can also find out about WYSO's Reinvention Project, a collaboration with local filmmakers Julia Reichert and Steve Bognar. WYSO is one of just 10 stations around the country to participate in the Localore Initiative, a $2 million project that teams up independent producers and public radio stations to invent new forms of reporting and storytelling. WYSO's Localore project is called Stories of Reinvention, and several of our Community Voices producers have joined the Reinvention team, hitting the streets to ask the question, how does a city of inventors reinvent itself? Check out facebook.com/reinventionstories for previews from this exciting multimedia project. And be sure to tune in next week for part two of the 2012 Community Voices special, stories about sacred harp singing, man caves, PTSD, the Dayton funk scene, and a locally produced slasher flick.
How's it going? You are literally in Gamma Knife Films HQ right now.
I used to watch the Ohio players practice when I was a kid in a garage.
You never know who's going to knock on that door. You never know what's going to happen. So it's kind of like a Las Vegas thing. Like what goes on here stays here.
It's the human voice that's the sacred harp. And when a group of voices get together, it can rattle the walls and make you feel like you're on the inside of a musical instrument.
Those stories and more next week on part two of WYSO's 2012 Community Voices special. Hallelujah.